This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Les Leopold. Les co-founded and directs two nonprofit educational organizations, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute, where he designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. He helped form the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together major labor unions and environmental groups. Les Leopold is here today to tell us about his book, The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and what we can do about it. Welcome, Les.
Thank you very much for having me.
What led you to write The Looting of America?
Well, there's actually two parts to that story. I got interested in these weird financial instruments that I couldn't understand. This was about 2 years ago. And I thought about writing something for people that would make finance more accessible, because I didn't know anything about it. And I thought, well, if I could figure it out, I could share it, because I had a feeling this was going to be important, but I had no idea how important. I kind of put it down for a while because it was getting too complicated for me. And then, boom, the economy collapsed. The financial sector collapsed. And I fortunately had done a lot of research on it already, so I pulled it together and created what I hope is a very accessible guide to what happened and what we can do about it.
In your book, you argue that the underlying cause of our recent economic downturn isn't the housing sector and subprime mortgages, but rather the financial instruments created over the past several years. Would you briefly describe these instruments and tell us how they helped lead to the economic crisis?
Well, actually, the story starts even a little bit earlier than that. There was a tremendous shift in the distribution of wealth starting in the mid-70s, and the gap between the top 1% and everybody else just became enormous. And the folks at the top, of course, wanted to invest their money, but they actually ran out of tangible investments that had reasonable risk. And Wall Street became very aware of this wall of money that was sitting out there. And they invented new financial instruments that could suck up this capital. First, they started to pull together various forms of risky credit, pools of subprime mortgages, and a lot of money got funneled in that direction. And that sort of started this subprime mortgage binge. But that only amounts to, if you added up all the subprime mortgages that have gone under, it amounts to maybe a third of what we've spent to try to cure the problem. So it can't be the subprime mortgage problem. It became too much of a pain to round up all these subprime mortgages. So they invented new things called derivatives that allowed people to sort of buy more and more securities that actually didn't own anything at all. They were more or less like bets, but they were rated AAA or AA, and they seemed to be very sound investments for these wealthy investors, and they got a slightly better return than they would have gotten had they bought, you know, regular corporate bonds or government securities. Well, in effect, what this did was, if you're from the New York area, it's like selling the Brooklyn Bridge several times. They sold the subprime loans, then they sold all these derivatives that were based upon the subprime loans. And I call those instruments fantasy finance instruments because there was nothing tangible that people owned when they owned those instruments. So imagine the following problem. You've got layer after layer of these fantasy finance instruments all keyed to risky debt. Supposedly, the risk had been engineered out of all this. But as soon as the housing market, which had gone up, shot up like a rocket, way beyond anything that ever had happened historically, the prices were rising so much more rapidly than they ever had before, they were bound to slow down and turn around. Once that happened, not only did it make tremendous problems for people who had subprime mortgages, but it crushed all the people and all the banks that owned these layer after layer of instruments based on the subprime mortgages. So it multiplied the problem. I call it the perverse miracle of the fishes and loaves. You turned the subprime mortgage problem, you multiplied it by three or four times, and that's how come you have several trillion dollars of financial toxic assets that are now littering the globe. And that's why they're having such a difficult time dealing with the toxic asset problem. There's so much of it, and it's these layers of derivatives.
Could you say more about how leveraging contributed to the economic troubles?
I would like to get away from the word leveraging, because it assumes that you're borrowing money from a bank and then buying something. Really what this is about, I think the best analogy I can provide is the leveraging that was taking place in here was literally creating new instruments where the leverages were built into it. And the best example comes from fantasy baseball. There are only 30 Major League Baseball teams. But fantasy baseball owners, quote-unquote, there's millions of them who are playing fantasy baseball, and they all own, quote-unquote, real Major League Baseball players, and they keep track of their statistics, and they compete against each other. And so they are leveraging on top of the real Major League Baseball game. And so these millions and millions of people are playing fantasy baseball. What happens to them if the major leagues go on strike? The fantasy baseball leagues are worthless. They can't do anything. They can't play. They're kaput. And that's kind of what happened when the subprime mortgages went down. All the derivatives that were based on top of them went kaput. That's where the leveraging took place. Yes, there was huge amounts of bank leveraging 30 to 1, 40 to 1, et cetera. But the real culprit were these layer after layer of financial instruments. And behind that was, where did all that money come from that came pouring into Wall Street? And we have to do something about that.
Would you speak also about how the benefits to the people selling these instruments contributed to the whole process?
Oh, this was the most profitable selling effort in the history of Wall Street. I'd say in the history of finance. Selling these fantasy finance instruments, creating them, selling them, trading them, was enormously profitable. And the more you minimize the risks, the more you could walk away with a profit based on your trades. And the way these trades work is, they can't call them insurance, but some of these are like insurance policies. They call them credit default swaps instead of insurance, because insurance is regulated, credit default swaps are not regulated. Well, when you are insuring somebody's portfolio of bonds, you have to determine how risky is it for those bonds to go under. Well, if you say there's a lot of risk there, then the fees you get have to be set aside to cover the risk. And your profit's going to be a lot lower as a trader. But if you can minimize the risk that you're going to report by saying, oh, this is really safe, then you can walk off with a huge fee and keep it without having to set it aside to cover your bets. And that's what happened again and again and again and again throughout the industry. Huge profits were made for the traders, for the firm. AIG ran a business where they offered this kind of credit default swap insurance to the tune of $450 billion. And they hardly set aside any money. So when the boom finally started to break apart, they had to cover their bets and couldn't. And now we, the taxpayers, are covering their bets for them.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Les Leopold, author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. At the beginning of your book, you speak about a Wisconsin school system that was burned by derivatives. Would you give a brief description of what happened to them?
Oh, what a tragedy. These five school systems were trying to raise money for what they call post-employment benefits, which are kind of basically it's pre-retiree health care costs. And they wanted to build up a fund to cover these costs. And a very able broker came to them and said, hey, I've got just the thing for you, AA, AAA bonds that you can buy, and you'll issue general revenue bonds for the down payment, that's $35 million. And then you can borrow $165 million from this Irish bank called DEFA. And then you'll buy $200 million worth of these, what he thought were bonds. And the difference between the money you borrowed and what you are going to get back is great enough so that you can pay off all your debts and you're going to build up this fund to help with the retirees. And they jumped on it. The guy selling them didn't know what he was selling. The people buying it on the school boards didn't know what they were buying. They ended up buying the same thing that AIG was involved in, and they didn't even know it. They thought they were buying a portfolio of bonds. All they did was they became the insurer of the Royal Bank of Canada's junk debt. They didn't even know they were doing that. And their $200 million is now worth about $6 million at most, and maybe less. They've lost nearly their entire investment, plus they still owe $200 million in loans. So they're in terrible shape. And like drugs, this stuff shouldn't have been within 1,000 yards of a school district, but it was unregulated. It was the era of, you know, let the buyer beware, free market will determine these products, and it was a tragedy, and they're not the only ones. This stuff was sold to pension funds across the country, you know, big industry, and a lot of people have been burned, but I think they got burned the most. Another place that got burned was a little town in Narvik in northern Norway. They had virtually the town savings got wiped out, and they owe all this money, and their budget had to be cut by 40%. So this stuff should not be near public finance. It should never have been near public finance. It's a tremendous failure on the part of the government, federal government, for letting this stuff run wild.
How effective is better regulation of the financial sector likely to be in preventing similar problems in the future?
Well, I'm a little skeptical, because as long as there's this wall of money coming towards Wall Street, if we don't do something serious about the maldistribution of income and wealth in the country, there'll be a huge pool of money that's seeking investments. And it's going to take an unbelievable amount of regulation to get that under control. Because, for example, they're talking about regulating these credit default swaps, but only the ones that are, you know, plain vanilla, that have nothing special going on with them. However, the ones that are kind of privately constructed, made to order, those aren't going to be regulated. Those are the dangerous ones. Those are the ones that have cost people, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and firms and school districts. Also, when you regulate one thing, they can piggyback something fancy on something else that you haven't regulated. So it's going to require incredible skill to stop the fantasy finance from going on. But there are two ways to kind of dry up the money. I think right now there's a debate going on about some kind of salary caps on Wall Street firms that were getting TARP money and the industry in general. And of course the industry is going bonkers over this. They don't want to, I mean, they're used to making tens of millions of dollars. They don't want to see a wage cap. So I'm suggesting actually that until unemployment comes down to below 5%, that nobody involved in the troubled parts of the financial sector should make more than the President of the United States, $400,000. I actually think that that kind of position could be easily sold to the American public, but right now, obviously, there's a battle going on over any kind of constraint. So I think your question is a good one. I think regulation will be difficult, but we have to move on several fronts at the same time. That's one of them.
Would you underscore the regulatory steps that you think would be most helpful?
Well, actually, I think what would be most helpful would be two things. One is a kind of product safety commission, financial product safety commission, that you couldn't sell anything on Wall Street unless it was approved by the product safety commission. You just couldn't sell any derivative. You had to get it approved first, like with the FDA. That gives you a chance to make a decision about whether there's a potential systemic harm. You know, is this product lethal or not? That's one thing. The second thing would be, which I think actually would be even more effective, would be a very, very small fee on each and every financial transaction. Sales of stocks, bonds, like let's say 3/10 of a penny. Stocks, bonds, all currency transactions, all the fancy options, everything. Every kind. Exempting nothing. And that would move money from the financial sector into the real economy, into the treasury, and then hopefully into infrastructure, you know, pay for the stimulus bill and other things that we need desperately in our economy. We have to get money out of the financial sector into the real economy and from the top of the income scale to the middle and bottom. And I'm talking the tippy top. I'm not talking upper middle class, you know, professionals. I'm talking people who are making $5, $10, $15 million a year. That money, somehow, we have to go back to sort of the Eisenhower days of steeply progressive income taxes.
In terms of the regulation, one concern you mentioned in your book is that competent regulators can be lured away from regulation by the high salaries paid by financial companies. Would you comment?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you're smart enough to regulate this stuff, why not take a $10 million a year job at a Wall Street firm? But if there are caps on the Wall Street firms, if we start bringing down that salary level back to the real world, that's the big asset boom, was the inflation of Wall Street salaries that, as it turned out, were based on producing garbage that sunk the economy that we're now paying up. We're over $1.5 trillion between TARP and stimulus. So if you have a cap on Wall Street, because it's not like any other sector, it almost can kind of create its own money. If you put a cap on that kind of compensation, then there won't be such a big gap between the regulators and people on Wall Street. Economists have been talking about it's time to turn finance back into the boring industry it's supposed to be. And there's truth to that. I mean, it's supposed to move money where it's needed in the real economy. That's what it's supposed to do. It's not supposed to create casino games.
Why haven't financial markets been more regulated in the recent past?
Well, not just the recent past. There was an enormous effort through the 70s and 80s to put forward free market ideology that said, when you deregulate finance, great things will happen. You will have an enormous investment boom. You will become the money handlers for the whole globe. That it was far more profitable to make fantasy finance instruments than to build cars or refrigerators or anything tangible or even computers. This was the future. And the way to get from here to there was deregulation. And the notion was that we had to undo all the constraints and controls from the New Deal, from the last depression, because it wasn't necessary anymore in the modern economy. We had to unleash innovation and invention in the financial sector. Well, that was deeply ingrained in all our policy people, Democrats and Republicans alike. Went along when one brave woman, Brooksley Bourne, tried to regulate credit default swaps or even raise the question. She got slammed by Democrats and Republicans for opening her mouth. They basically said she didn't know what she was talking about. Well, she was right. And the free market ideology doesn't work in the financial sector. It works wonderfully, perhaps, in the real economy, but it's a disaster in the financial sector. We now are witnessing, we just went through a full-scale financial crash. Bam! Right in front of our very eyes, very much like 1929. And it was the philosophy of deregulation, which, of course, went along perfectly with letting money rise to the top 1%. Was part of the same ideology. Let it go to the top, it'll be invested wisely, we'll have a very healthy financial sector, and we'll have great prosperity. Didn't work. We now have gone through that 30-year experiment. It was a failure, and we have to face up to it. We have to get past the ideological blinders.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Les Leopold, author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. Well, you've already alluded to this, but what, in addition to regulation, can our society do to protect itself from what you call fantasy finance?
Well, the one that I mentioned was probably the most short-term effective one would be the excise tax on financial transactions. But I think we also have to really focus on what we're going to do about the gigantic and ever-growing income and wealth gap in this country. Just to give you a sense of it, I mean, you know, I hate to bore people with numbers, but there's some that are just too astounding to ignore. In 1970, the top 100 CEOs, on average, earned $40 for every dollar the average worker earned, 40 to 1. By 2006, the gap was 1,700 to 1. That's some change. There's a broader measure that compares countries. The United States, in 2000, the gap was 495 to 1. The next highest country was South Africa at 50 to 1. Japan was 10 to 1. Germany, 11 to 1. Switzerland, 11 to 1. Sweden, 14 to 1. Canada, 21 to 1. Britain, 25 to 1. We were 495 to 1. There's academic research that makes it clear that when you let the wage and wealth gap get large, your economy is prone to collapse. And it happened. The last study I looked at was from 2004, 3 years, 4 years before it happened. Then it did happen. So we have to do something about that, and there's a lot that can be done. Right now, we're looking at roughly 30 million people that are unemployed or underemployed. We need to find, you know, productive work for those folks, and that has to be paid for, both through public and private investment. The money for that is going to have to come from the people who have it, the top 400 billionaires, 400 of them, combined have wealth that equals $1.56 trillion. 400 people. That's obscene. If they each lived on $100 million each, $100 million, you would have $1.5 trillion to invest in the real economy, which is enough, by the way, to provide probably in perpetuity, if it was invested, in perpetuity, free higher education at every public college, university, two-year college in the entire country, free tuition. So you're talking about a tremendous distortion of income. So you need progressive income taxes. You need a higher minimum wage. We need to encourage higher wages at the workplace. I don't see any other way other than through unionization. We need some sort of moderation of unfettered globalization policies. For example, I think we need to bring environmental carbon issues into trade. So if we can make steel through cleaner energy here, it seems to me that we don't want to import steel that's made with carbon-intensive energy in, let's say, India or China. We need some sort of a border adjustment tax to take into account the carbon components of imports, because we're shifting things all over the world and we're not taking into account the carbon footprint that the trade is producing. All these things can be done. The net effect would be to narrow that gap, which then would make the country much stronger. It would suck up some of this money that ends up flowing into the fantasy finance casino. One thing average Americans don't do is they don't take their savings and buy derivatives. They may go to Las Vegas, but they're not going to take their savings and invest it in Wall Street derivatives. So you get kind of a virtuous cycle when money's in the hands of middle and lower income people. An increase in the minimum wage is absolutely necessary and has to be key to inflation so it doesn't get gutted. It makes a big difference. It makes a big difference to the incomes of lower income people.
Well, we're running a bit short on time, but could you just very briefly talk about the advantages of nationalizing our banking system, which you suggest in the book?
Well, we've already nationalized most of it. So the question now becomes, what are you going to do with it? It's a very thorny question, and I sort of gingerly go up to it at the end, which is, I'm not sure, and I'm not the only one. I mean, Keynes and other economists were also worried about this problem. There's an instability in finance within a modern capitalist economy. And the question is, how do you control that finance? And it could very well be that if you're going to pour trillions of dollars into them, you may want to actually run them as a public utility. You might be able to get more stability. I'm not convinced that turning them over back to private investors is going to work. You know, we really have poured a lot of money into these firms right now. And we've ended up buying up, it looks like, you know, GM and Chrysler as well, because of collateral damage caused by the financial crash. So if you've gone that far, I think what I'm really calling for is a very serious dialogue about how to run this sector in the future. If we value free enterprise in the real economy, we may have to have a much more utility model for the financial sector. That's what it is. It's a public utility. It doesn't seem to run very well as a private, for-profit, you know, too-big-to-fail institutions. Something has to be done.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
My message is this. In order to be an empowered citizen in this era, we have to know something about finance. I'm hoping that Looting of America is an opportunity for folks to find a book that's easy to read and will actually help create an understanding. Because if we don't have a shared understanding of how the system works, we're going to be out of the debate. We won't know what's going on. We're going to leave it to the experts. And you know what? We can't afford to do that.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Les.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity.
We have just been speaking with Les Leopold, author of The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It, published in 2009 by Chelsea Green Publishing. For more information, check on the web at lootingofamerica.org. Again, that's lootingofamerica.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.